Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 150 years ago this morning, 4:30 a.m., Confederate cannon opened fire on Union forces at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, and four terrible years of bloody war began. The Civil War remains the deadliest conflict in American history. In the next 4 years, we will see anniversary after big anniversary, sesquicentennials from that war, the war that ended slavery. Today, we talk with historian David Goldfield about the passions that drove the country to war. This hour On Point, from the beginning, the Civil War. This morning in Charleston, South Carolina, a reenactment mortar salvo was fired toward Fort Sumter to mark the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War. Reenacting the beginning of the war there. There's applause, but it was a terrible war. You can join the conversation this hour. What does the Civil War mean to you 150 years after it began? What about the passions that drove it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Charlotte, North Carolina, is David Goldfield. He's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, author of many works of Southern history, including Still Fighting the Civil War and Promised Land. His new history is America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Goldfield, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you with us today.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here with you.
There's that sound from Charleston this morning of the reenactment, that little rumble of mortar fire that 150 years ago set the whole thing off. And you heard the kind of applause and cheering. I guess that's a natural human response to big booms and flashes. But we still have very complicated emotional reactions to everything, it seems to me, to do with this war, David.
We certainly do. And in fact, the applause and cheering replicated to a great degree what the people of Charleston experienced in 1861. Many stood on their rooftops watching the salvos fly across the harbor onto Fort Sumter. And they cheered as the bombardment continued, and eventually, of course, the fort surrendered. Mm-hmm.
The cheers were there, and so many would die, more than 600,000, even with the technology of that time, more than any other American war. We're going to dive deep into the passions that drove the country to that war, but take us just back, because we're going to have 4 years of this, David. Take us back to that morning and the forces that were arrayed, that historical moment that led to the kickoff of the war. It was, of course, it was the Confederates on land, Union soldiers out on that island in the middle of Charleston Harbor. And what was the circumstance that led sort of the pincers that led that to be the moment, that to be the place where all this began?
Major Anderson was the Union or Federal commander of the fort, and he didn't really have many troops at his disposal. And in fact, in a few days, his supplies would have run out, in which case he would have abandoned the fort and gone back to wherever the initial deployment was. But President Lincoln was intent on supplying the fort, and this created the conflict. President Jefferson Davis of the Confederate States of America had issued an ultimatum saying that if you try to supply Major Anderson, we're going to fire on the fort. We'll view it as a hostile act. And that's precisely what he did, although some of his colleagues, particularly Confederate Secretary of State Robert Toombs, begged Davis not to fire the first shot because he felt that this would unite the North, and the North was certainly not united behind President Lincoln or the Republicans at the time, and firing the first shot on an American flag would likely result in a war.
And so it did. I've read somewhere just in the last couple of days, something like 65,000 books have been written on the American Civil War. Now you've brought another big volume, and it's getting a tremendous response. I know you are a Southern historian. What were you looking for, coming back again to the Civil War? What were you looking to explore this time, David?
When I wrote Still Fighting the Civil War, Tom, two things really stood out to me. One was the central importance of religion, particularly evangelical Protestantism, in developing the culture of the South. It was just an indelible part of Southern culture. And the second thing that stood out to me was how Southerners, Confederates, came home after the war and how maimed in mind and body they were. In fact, the first indication of what we call today post-traumatic stress disorder was noted in Civil War veterans, and the first treatise was written in 1876. Now, they didn't call it that.
And it was surely not just Southerners who must have suffered.
Not at all. But in doing the research for that that book, I was mainly concerned with Southerners. So I wanted to expand this to see what the role of evangelical religion was, not only among Union soldiers, but in bringing about the war. And secondly, looking at the soldiers themselves, their diaries, their letters home, their conversations, how they viewed the war as it was going on and how they viewed the war once they came home.
You call the war, right in the first page, America's greatest failure. Now, I suppose we could look at the unrivaled number of dead and say, just on its face, just with the death toll, you could classify it that way. But what do you mean by that? What's the whole of your meaning?
I meant that it was a breakdown in our political process. Our political process depends upon compromise and moderation. The greatest legislation in our history has really come about as a result of compromise and moderation, from the New Deal legislation of the 1930s to the Civil Rights legislation of the 1960s. Compromise isn't a glamorous process. It's sort of like making sausage. You don't really want to see it, but the outcome usually tastes pretty good, and over time it generally works pretty well. But what happened in the years and decades before the Civil War is that moderation and compromise became less likely. The political center, and we governed best as a nation from the center, became polarized, so you didn't have that center holding things together. People moved off toward the extremes. And that really made compromise very, very difficult. It made it more difficult because the reason why people were being polarized and the reason why the center was eroding was that political issues of the day, particularly slavery, immigration, and particularly the immigration of Irish Catholics, not only became politicized, but they became moral issues as well. So your opponent was not only misinformed or misguided, your opponent was a sinner, was evil, and a bad person. And how do you compromise with sin?
But how do you? How do you compromise on slavery, on human bondage, or even on the sort of very substantial economic interests that were tied up in slavery?
Well, as a nation, we had compromised on slavery. We compromised on slavery in the framing of the Constitution in 1787, during the Missouri controversy of 1820, and during the admission of California as a state in 1850. So the precedent was there for compromise, and there were various points along the process where compromise or backing down could have resolved the situation, maybe only temporarily. But the key thing to keep in mind here, Tom, is that seven states had seceded by the time Abraham Lincoln took office. And had a compromise been reached, or had Lincoln or Davis backed down from their ultimatums, war might have been averted. And those seven Confederate states could not really have lasted long in world affairs. First of all, very few countries would have recognized a slaveholding republic, and this was a great problem that the Confederacy had during the war. And secondly, a lot of slaves, all of a sudden we're in a border state, and we could just cross the line and take our chances elsewhere. So it might have been a very different dynamic. Now, I'm just speculating here, Tom, to be honest with you, because...
Well, you seem to be suggesting if there was a compromise, it might well have been built, a compromise built, again, as in the Constitution, on the backs of African-American slaves.
Well, let's look at what happened after the war, Tom. African-Americans really did not achieve the fruits of that freedom for more than a century. In 1888, Frederick Douglass gave a really searing speech and where he pronounced the Emancipation Proclamation as a fraud. He looked around him and saw African-Americans, not in chains, of course, but they were deprived of their civil rights, in many cases haphazard violence against them, and in all cases, their ability to improve themselves really, really restricted. So the question arises, and people who read my book, I would like them to come away with asking two questions. One, was this war necessary? And secondly, was there another way we could have achieved the objectives of liberation and saving the Union without a bloody war that killed 620,000 men?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking on the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War about the passions that drove the country from disagreement to actual war, our deadliest war. David Goldfield joins us, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. His new book is America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. There's an excerpt at our website. We went out of that last segment, David, with Tenting Tonight on the old campground, the Rhett Tyler Band playing there. This was a favorite of enlisted men in the Union Army, written in 1863 by Walter Kittredge. But you hear right there that sort of gauzy glory, that almost a homey sound to it, music from what you describe as just the most national, terrible national experience of all that we've had.
That's true, Tom, but there's another song called When This Cruel War Is Over, and that song was periodically banned by both sides. It was very popular with the soldiers, and it consisted of phrases concerning the longing of soldiers for their families, for their loved ones. Union commanders encouraged the singing of troops of very upbeat and popular songs, but many of the troops had very different feelings about the war than their songs indicated. After all, the slaves often sang in the fields, and masters misapprehended what they were doing. They thought, well, you know, they're singing, so they're happy. But the hearts of many soldiers were very heavy during this awful war. I mean, it was not unusual for a young man to be eating his breakfast with his comrade, and a mortar shell fell into the group, and he'd find his comrade's brains splattered all over his breakfast plate. I don't want to sound too graphic here, but I mean, some of those scenes are in the book. But this Sherman said famously, "War is hell," and this war was particularly hellish. It was fought with the most modern weapons at the time, but with older strategies and tactics. And these were young men from farms and small towns across the country who had never experienced anything like that. These were civilian armies. These weren't professional soldiers.
You know, we're getting a lot of response just to your first comments, David, online, and I can see it lining up on the telephones as well. And a lot of it pushing back really hard. You know, here's one. The Civil War is America's greatest failure. It ended slavery, ushered in the Industrial Revolution. How is that a failure? Or another online from John saying, didn't compromise and moderation just delay the inevitable? People pushing back on the very kind of grounds that you're describing here. And I wondered if you would take us back to one of the places, the early points that you point to is 1858. Abraham Lincoln, he's just accepting the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate seat in Illinois. And he takes as his text in this speech, and it seems to go right to your characterization of passion in the North and South, often religiously rooted, but he takes from the Gospels, Matthew 12:25, and he quotes, "And Jesus knew their thoughts and said unto them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand." And there you see the seed of the house divided speech. I mean, here's Lincoln himself, who's talking in the most fundamental ways. Was he not about a divided house?
Yes, and it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, this is the difficulty with using the Bible and evangelical religion to process political issues because they're extremely polarizing. And because they're polarizing, they really cannot be adjudicated very well in the political process, particularly our political process, which requires this give and take and at least a grounding of respect for the opposition.
But where does morality come in? I mean, Lincoln was saying in that speech, talking about the slavery issues, that it's not merely a political question, the kind for that sort of political give and take. You know, you write yourself, he described it as a test of America's democratic and religious ideals. Quoting him, "It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world."
There is no doubt that slavery is immoral, and certainly I don't imply anything else in, mm-hmm. in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But my point isn't that, we had to have slavery. We had to have war to get rid of slavery. My point is that the good thing, getting rid of slavery, may have been accomplished by another means or other means. We were the only nation in the world to abolish slavery with a civil war. So maybe other models were out there. And again, I'm speculating here. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This never happened. So we do know what happened. But the fact is that the cost of this war, not only in the lost lives, but in the millions of people who mourned these young men and the men who came home maimed in mind and body, these consequences of the war, I think, should give us pause before we say, yeah, you know, let's. This is a great war. It liberated slaves, and it brought about the Industrial Revolution, which I make very clear it did not in any case. But there might have been alternatives if men would have gotten together and not raised the stakes from political disagreement to a cause of God or the devil.
David Goldfield is with us. His new History is America, Aflame. New York Times calls it riveting, often heartbreaking. Could you describe, you say a religious framing, an evangelical religious framing, was key to driving this forward to war in both the North and the South. And I wish you'd, but they're not the same framing in North and South. And I wish you'd describe each of those. South, North, what was the religious frame in each for this?
No, you're absolutely right, Tom. And in fact, during the mid-1840s, the two major evangelical denominations, the Baptists and the Methodists at the time, split into a northern half and a southern half, and they went along their separate and unmerry ways. In the North, evangelical Protestantism really didn't focus initially on the slavery issue. It focused on the Catholic issue, particularly as a result of Irish Catholic immigration into the U.S. The concern was that Irish Catholics would not owe their allegiance to the President of the United States, but rather to the Pope in Rome. And also they would make very poor Democrats with a small D because they were more accustomed to working within a hierarchy and having people order them or tell them what to do.
How do their attitudes about Irish Catholics factor into the American Civil War?
Ah, okay. Well, you brought up the 1858 senatorial election in Illinois that Lincoln ran, and the Republican Party, which was a relatively new party at the time, was founded just 3 or 4 years earlier. Lincoln ran under the banner, under the slogan of the Republican Party in Illinois in 1858, to vanquish the twin despotisms, Catholicism and slavery. The Republican Party was an amalgam of other parties. The Whig Party had disintegrated in the early 1850s. An anti-Catholic party called the Know-Nothing Party had emerged and then subsided. And many of these individuals came together in the Republican Party. So you had a Republican Party was both anti-slavery and anti-Catholic. And they viewed both the Catholic faith and slavery as the two greatest threats to America at that time. And in fact, Tom, had you walked down the streets of Boston or Philadelphia or New York in the late 1850s and you had collared a Protestant working man, he would say, yes, yeah, slavery, you know, slavery, that's the big issue of the day. No, he would have said, oh, we got to do something about these Catholics. They're taking my job, they're taking my house, and they're just disrupting the public schools and
But
so
how does
on.
That come into the path to war? If you ask about religious fervor in the North, I would have thought that the central issue you might have turned to would be the abolitionist movement and the religious roots and framing of that movement.
No, Tom. The abolition movement was a very, very small movement. The Republican Party made it very clear it was the white man's party. It wanted to keep slaves out of the territories. It wanted to keep
the Western territories.
Mm-hmm. The Western territories, right. It wanted to keep the Western territories open for ambitious white men and women. And the Republicans felt that they would not be able to compete successfully if they had to compete against slave labor.
And so the Irish Catholic piece, again, how does that factor into the war? We weren't going to war about the Pope in Rome.
No, but the Republican Party was formed with these two groups, these two major interests. And the 1860 election, in which Abraham Lincoln was victorious, many of the votes that he received in the cities of the Northeast and Midwest came from these Protestant working men who were not very concerned about the slavery issue, but were very, very concerned about the issue of Roman Catholics. Most of our political parties, as you know, Tom, are coalitions. They include people with sometimes disparate views. I mean, look at the Democratic Party in the early 20th century. You had Catholic and Jewish immigrants in the North, and you had social and racial conservatives in the South, and they adhered together as a party. So it's not unusual to bring these two strands together. But I think what these two strands have in common, Tom, is that they are self-righteous. They exude an air of certitude, and they believe that people who disagree with them are not only, as I said, misinformed and misguided, but they're also evil people.
Turn to the religious framing of the issue of the day in the South then, David.
Southern evangelicals believed that the most important aspect of their faith was the individual's conversion, that is, the individual's acceptance of Jesus Christ as his or her personal Savior. Northern evangelicals, of course, believed this as well, but they had a much broader view and looked at the society at large and believed that in order to hasten the second coming of Jesus Christ, society had to extirpate its sins. And there were two main sins as far as the evangelicals were concerned, Roman Catholics. And in fact, one Protestant minister used the word exterminate as an acceptable policy against Roman Catholics. And the other was, of course, slavery.
And the religious passion here, again, are you putting slavery to the side? Was religion not wrapped around slavery itself?
Oh, of course religion was wrapped around slavery because eventually the Southerners, under attack as a result of being slaveholders, Southerners came to the defense of their institution and they say, hey, look, you know, excuse me, we're converting slaves. We're bringing them to the gospel. And also this is part of God's order. Slavery is sanctioned in the Bible. It's not condemned in the Bible at all. So Northern evangelicals, you are not only misreading the Bible, but you are casting this issue into the political arena. And it's interesting, Tom, to read some leading Southern ministers and political leaders, and they're saying, hey, keep religion out of politics. because obviously a church and state need to be separate in our country. Of course, that's sort of ironic when you look at the South today, but nevertheless, this was their accurate view of the situation.
David Goldfield, stand by. I want to begin to bring in our listeners. Anne is calling from Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've done a lot of reading about the Civil War, and of course, what I've found is, of course, the victorious side tends to do most of the writing. But I want to talk about just at a macro level that I haven't studied other civil wars of other countries, but I think that the American Civil War is unique in its incredible intensity and how emotional, because Americans, these were Americans, no matter whether you believed in what the South believed in or whether you believe in what the North believed in, these people were passionately believing in what they were fighting for. And I don't know how this compares with other foreign civil wars, but I feel somehow proud of this American way of just really stepping up and fighting for what they believe in, and also this religion aspect of this. When you look at specific battles like the Fredericksburg Battle, where Union soldiers were marching against Confederates up a hill, and row after row were being mowed down, and then pickets charged the other side. The Southerners were coming up and mowed down one after the other. They saw, they saw the previous people. They really believed. They had a religious belief in the afterlife, and I don't think today's soldiers, honestly, I don't think they would be willing to do that. I think it was such a tragic war because of these different various aspects of it.
And let us pick it up, if we may, right there. You put a lot on the table. David Goldfield, there's, from Anne, pride in the passion, the depth of belief that drove the war. What do you say?
Well, two things I can respond to that. First, when a soldier is marching into battle, at least from the diaries and the letters of the soldiers themselves, they're not thinking of God and country. If they're thinking of anything, they're thinking of their loved ones back home. But in the heat of the battle, they're thinking of getting out alive and hopefully winning the battle. When they're wounded, they're thinking of becoming whole again. And when they're lying in a hospital bed and suffering from some disease or dying from their wounds, they're not really thinking of great causes. I think we tend to project onto these soldiers emotions that they may have felt going in enlisting. But by 1863 and certainly by 1864, the war had gone on long enough for soldiers to know that this was really just a bloodbath, and the sooner they could end it, the better. These soldiers dreaded the beginning of spring, right about now when everything is blooming and everything is beautiful, because that meant a recurrence of fighting. They really didn't have that depth of conviction that would propel them in a particular battle. Their main objective was to survive, and hopefully their comrades would survive as well.
And yet they charged in those famous
charges. They were told to do that.
David Goldfield, stand by. We have to take a short break here. Here's All Quiet Along the Potomac tonight, originally a poem set to music in 1863 by John Hill Hewitt, musician serving in the Confederate Army. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are talking on the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. about the passions that drove the country from disagreement to actual war. 150 years ago, our deadliest war. David Goldfield is with me, professor of history, University of North Carolina. His new book is America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David, lots of response to this online, and I have to say a lot of it pushing back against your perspective here. Here's Greg says, war might have been averted. I wonder what the guest's opinion of Neville Chamberlain is, and more to that effect. Let me get Bill on the line here. Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill's calling. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you. Your guest is boiling my blood big time. Number one, you talked about compromise and reasonable men getting together. Maybe they could have reasoned their way out of this mess. Well, reasonable men did get together, and each compromise was worse than the next compromise. There was no way to compromise out of people losing their freedom or abusing immigrants. It's that simple. And by the way, while we're on the subject of compromises, your guest mentioned that civil rights wasn't achieved until about 100, 150 years later, whatever. And he's right about that.
Yep.
And the reason being was, after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, all attempts at civil rights was abandoned because the Republican Party compromised with the Southerners at that time in order to get the country back into shape and calm down passions. And that's when the Ku Klux Klan and all these other organizations were in their heyday and proceeded from there. And by the way, from one particular historical point of view, we were not the only country that overthrew slavery violently. Haiti did exactly the same thing.
A little different population, but certainly by means of war. Bill, I appreciate your call. David Goldfield, there's the voice of the skepticism. We should paint the compromise that you imagine might have been possible here. Bill just doesn't hear it. I can tell you others don't as well. But if there was one possible, what might it have looked like?
Well, first let me say that I didn't say that it was the only U.S. was the only country to abolish slavery with violence. I said through a civil war. But in terms of compromise, and again, Tom, this is just speculation on my part.
Of course.
Because it didn't happen.
Counterfactual.
Right. Exactly. I think the best case scenario from what we know of the historical record is that there would have been sufficient guarantees for the protection of slavery where it existed that the states of the Upper South, including North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee, among others, would not have seceded, leaving Confederate States of America with only the Deep South states. That would have had been very difficult to survive for the reasons I mentioned earlier, the lack of international recognition and assistance and the porous borders that would have existed. I think the call.
So in other words, the compromise would have meant a continued tolerance of slavery within the Union. That would be central to the compromise.
That would be central to the compromise, but I think it's continued tolerance toward a greater end, and that is the eventual demise of slavery with the inclusion of civil rights for African Americans. The caller makes a very good point that the Republicans compromised on slavery after the Civil War. It wasn't really a compromise. They just abandoned it.
Walked away.
There was no compromise at all. But if, one of the things I do in the book is I go through very carefully the racial views of Northerners, of white Northerners and white Southerners, and they really weren't that different. Almost all white Americans believed in the inferiority of African Americans. And in that climate, it would have been very difficult for African Americans to achieve any type of civil rights after the Civil War. But when you do have a bloody war, and when white Southerners particularly blamed African Americans for that war, and when white Northerners also just disgusted with the blood and carnage of the war blamed African Americans, it became less likely. And it was a very, very long haul until African Americans achieved their civil rights. I mentioned Frederick Douglass earlier and his disillusionment. I think If we might have had a compromise, yes, it would have delayed the abolition of slavery, but in the long run, it might have been a much better scenario for African Americans to become full American citizens.
Do you think the South would have agreed to some kind of timeline for dismantling? Is there anything in historical record that suggests that, or are you suggesting that it simply would have been changing economics and international, what opprobrium that over time would have pulled the plug on it?
I think the South would have been much more open to economic arguments and economic realities rather than the persuasion of any kind, because it would have been unlikely for the lower South states to remain viable economically with a very large slave population and with the international opprobrium that would have existed, not to mention hostility among states along their borders and up throughout the remaining United States.
Listener Kevin is saying here that that people were looking for free, cheap labor, a big interest in the South. He writes, and much of the motivation for the Civil War, in my opinion, he says, was poor white Southerners terrified of becoming that labor if blacks gained equality. Shelby in Westerly, Rhode Island. Shelby, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Thank you, Professor. I'm just wondering, I'm an economist, so we're sort of paid to oversimplify things, but I'm wondering if anyone has looked at the whole idea of what the North would have had to pay to end this peacefully by buying out all the slaves and making a payment in return for no future slavery to Southern slaveholders.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Claudia Golden of Harvard University, an economic historian, has made exactly that calculation. She calculated that the cost of the Civil War on both sides was about $6.2 billion. That would have been enough money to free every slave by compensating the master, and that would have resulted in about $3 billion, and have enough money left over for reparations for past wages for the previous 250 years to each former slave, and also to give to purchase land for each former slave so that they could begin as independent landowners.
Was that ever seriously discussed?
No, because obviously Professor Golden is working from hindsight here. We didn't know what the war would cost in 1861, and even if we had, it was doubtful that President Lincoln, had he offered it, would have had any takers. Interesting thing about President Lincoln, as late as at the end of March of 1865, when the war was pretty much a foregone conclusion, the outcome of the war was a pretty foregone conclusion, he was still talking about compensation and maybe delaying emancipation, or in his conversations with Confederate Vice President Alexander Stephens, who had been a close friend of his.
Let me go to Tony in Nashville, Tennessee. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was at a party recently where a fellow guest was espousing the view that the North was really responsible for the Civil War in the fact that they, or in his view, I'm saying a fact, but that the North had a lot of industrialized technology that they would not share with the South, and that in order to keep the wheels of the economy rolling, the South had to secede from the Union in order to sort of gain overcome the technological advantage of the North.
To protect slavery, you mean, as its economic engine, is
well, and you know, that's the modern viewpoint of it, and he claims that this was a revisionist history and that sort of thing. I personally, don't share that point of view, but I've yet to talk to an historian who is not afraid to sort of go outside the box and express alternate views of kind of what went on. So I'll just
Tony, let us pick it up. What about that argument, David? That it wasn't necessarily passion; it was the economic interests grinding inexorably toward war.
First, both sides were responsible for the war. You can't put it on one side or the other. And Abraham Lincoln said as much in his marvelous second inaugural address in March of 1865. In terms of economics, consider this, Tom. A Republican administration coming in that received support only in the North. In fact, Lincoln was not even on the ballot in many southern states. So his constituents and the constituency of the Republican Party was almost exclusively in the North. So the Republican Party advocated a very strong policy of economic nationalism, that is, using the federal government to subsidize the construction of transcontinental railroads, the improvement of rivers and harbors to improve commerce, the establishment of a national banking system, and the establishment of national land-grant colleges to educate young men, primarily young men. Now, in this economic nationalism, Southerners were rightfully worried that where would they fit in? Would a transcontinental railroad have a southern route? The answer was no. Would a national bank have interest rates much higher in the South? The answer after the war, yes. And Lincoln, of course, had the power of appointing a number of people into important positions in the South, particularly in collecting customs and in the post office. Would the South be bombarded with incendiary literature that would be placed there by Republican postmasters? So the issue of economics is, I think the caller's friend at this party made a good point. But, of course, at bottom, the economic issue is the issue of slavery, because the core of the Southern economy was slavery. And all of these things I mentioned that the Republican Party would do, and in fact did do during the Civil War, would have adversely affected the institution of slavery.
Get one more call, if I may. Tony, thanks, in Nashville, Montgomery, Alabama. Jim, thank you for calling. Jim, you're on the air with David Goldfield.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Professor. I think it's an interesting premise, but my experience in a place where they still have Confederate Memorial Day and Jefferson Davis's birthday and Robert E. Lee and all the cultural depth that runs so proud with, I really think this was just a group of people who believed they were endowed with an inalienable right from God to own other people and, you know, to lord over them, that this was their duty in life and that God gave them this power and that no one was going to stop them, and they were ready to destroy, you know, to step on the Constitution and tear it up and secede from the Union. And that's what the Civil War started, and that as Abraham Lincoln grew, and as the leaders, but basically Lincoln grew to understand that black emancipation and that slavery was the underlying issue, that it evolved into that.
But that fundamentally Southerners were not going to compromise on that. Jim in Montgomery, thank you for your call. David, there's a kind of skepticism born out of, you know, Jim's reading today, looking through the prism of life today back toward the Civil War, that what you're suggesting might truly have been possible.
Well, I don't know, and we don't know if it would have been truly possible. The caller makes the very good point that Southerners were very self-righteous in their defense of slavery. Northerners were very self-righteous in their opposition to slavery and to Roman Catholics, or at least Northern evangelicals in the Republican Party were. So there was a lot of self-righteousness. There was a lot of certitude. There was a lot of feeling that God is on our side. But as Abraham Lincoln indicated, we don't know whose side God was on. Certainly, you can't make an argument that God was on anybody's side because of the carnage and blood of the war.
There is so much history between the covers of your volume, this volume, but at the same time, I can't help but hear an argument addressed to us today about passions today and maybe even dangers today in our American body politic.
It's interesting, Tom. When I first started writing this book in about 2007, I really wasn't thinking of that because our political system, while not in great shape, was moving along. But now I see the same type of polarization, the same type of erosion of the center, and the same passions and the same triumph of ideology over ideas that existed in the years preceding the Civil War. Now, I'm not predicting that we're going through another Civil War, but you can see what happens in a government when compromise and moderation just are not allowed to work. We get a virtual standstill. And unfortunately, in 1861, that standstill became a civil war.
What are you hoping people bear in mind over these next 4 years and more as sesquicentennial after sesquicentennial greets us in the Civil War? Many American families, maybe yours, I don't know, certainly mine, had you know, members who fought in that war. People will be thinking, and all Americans are touched by it. What are you hoping that people bring to their contemplation?
I think this should not be a celebration. I think we should have a commemoration. We should honor the men who fought and died, and we should admire their courage. But we should also conclude that it would have been a greater tribute to our nation had these men lived.
Even at the cost of compromise, we'll see. I'm afraid this is going to be a debate that goes on through the war. Here's another commenter online. It was radicalism that brought us the 14th Amendment, one of the great achievements in human history. We wouldn't have had that without the Civil War. The pushback goes on there, David. I hope we can talk again over these next 4 years as the celebrations, or as you say, commemorations do roll out, about how we look back. And I appreciate you very much your being with us today, David Goldfield.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'll look forward to talking with you again.
David Goldfield's new history is America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.